Hi, Brian. Welcome to AirHacks FM.
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, it is not Brian in the Netherlands, right?
It is
pronounced Brian? Really?
It is pronounced Brian. My mother gave me an English name, so...
Ah, okay. Because it would be a Dutch name, it would be Brian.
Yeah, I think that's more Nordic, as in Danish or something, that they will pronounce this as Brian. But
I never heard Brian, but I just noticed that. Brian. Okay.
No. I mean, there is a Danish football player called Brian Laudrup, and that's how I knew. Like,
and football is soccer, or what is football? Football is soccer, right?
Like football is football, like European football.
European football. Okay.
So what the Americans would call soccer, but yeah, football.
Okay. Okay, so we learned something new here at AirHacks, and the very important question is: what was your first computer?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. I mean, I think the first computer that I operated was my dad's computer, actually, and that was a Commodore 64, and for me it was more on gaming. It was like I was a kid. I loved to play the games. I can remember vividly. I remember a racing game, a Formula One game, that we tried. But the first computer that I owned myself, I think that was a 468 DX2 machine, I guess.
Wow.
With Windows 3.1. That's what I recall.
So that was 3.11, right? So one.
No. 3.1. Wow. I know that I had to migrate from 3.1 to 3.11, which was a minor thing, but 3.1. That's how I recall it. But so 3.1, 3.11, that were in the same era. That is the first computer that I owned as a kid when I was in high school. It was the old machine of my dad, and I inherited it, so I could do all sorts of stuff on it. There was no internet connection yet on it, but you know what I mean.
So it was your first enterprise migration from 3.1 to 3.11, right?
I think so. It was my first enterprise migration on my own machine.
Okay. And you did some serious programming on C64, was just about gaming?
I did not do some serious programming. I tried some
basic.
I tried some basic and some Pascal.
No, this was just a joke, the serious programming. But at least you started, you know, the basic. You have to use basic a bit to load the games, but was something beyond that, you know, like?
There were some things later on, say end of high school, but then I already was migrated to other machines, and then I started programming in Turbo, Pascal, and Basic.
Why you started programming?
Ooh, I think it was because I found out that I could do more with computers than the programs allowed me to. As in, hey, I can do things myself. I can make things. I can create things, and that was fun. I think that was the main reason. And you can interact with it, and you can make it do. Or at least try to make it do whatever you want it to do instead of conforming to whatever the software developer that you're using the program from was trying to make you do.
But what you wanted to achieve, you know, was like...
I don't think there was yet anything to achieve. It was, for me, it was just playing around and figuring out that there was another world around that. And you could, in this way, I could stand out of the crowd. Like, a lot of folks did have a computer, but did not use a computer beyond the regular things. And then it was, oh, you're the guy that can do this. And then later on it was, oh, you're the guy that can create web pages. And that's the point. Like, okay.
Okay,
yep, I can do that.
So you did it basically because of girls, right? You wanted to be the cool guy, you know. I can do some Turbo Pascal, right?
I don't think it was because of girls. I think that the girls will be like, yeah, boring. So no, it was never because of girls. It was more of this, like, I found something that I enjoyed, and it people looked to you like, okay, you do that? Oh, that's cool. I'm like, yeah. Okay. And probably in my nerd group of people, it was kind of cool that you could do that, and other people started doing that as well in my group. So it was interesting.
So you are the early influencer, you can say, right?
Maybe there were a couple of friends with me that did pretty much the same at that mm-hmm. level. So I'm not saying I'm the only early influencer, but I think I started quite early if I compare it to the rest of my groups and classes mm-hmm. and the people that I went to school with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you did some. So you started to program on the DX on the PC, was the Intel already, mm-hmm. and with Turbo Pascal, because you said, okay, the available software is not enough. Let's create something to play around.
Well, basically, just playing around and see mm-hmm. what the possibilities are. I mean, as a kid, I was always intrigued by electronics, and mm-hmm. I was the kid that was like, hey, you've got a small machine or a small, like these games that we had back in the day that it was an electronic game, it was not a Game Boy, but before that you could only play one game on it, and I was the one that was like, where's my screwdriver, how can I dismantle it, how does it look from the inside? And I think it all started with that, and then it was like, okay, with a computer I know how it looks on the inside because I helped. All right. Well, I was there when my dad built the computer, because back in the day you build your own computer. It's not that you just buy a thing. Mm-hmm. You build a main board, and you put your own memory in it, and et cetera. So I learned that from a young age. That was like a point. Like, okay, but you can also influence the way it works. That is interesting, and I know that it was possible, obviously, but now it's like, okay, this is quite available to you as well, mm-hmm. like maybe in a smaller amount. So let's play around with it. Let's see what we can do with that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was basically an experiment that got out of hand, and now okay. I'm a developer.
And was this something? I mean, you created something not remarkable, something beyond Hello World.
Oh, I think we started to find out how to interact with a terminal, and then create some sort of calculator mm-hmm. kind of application. So the very basic applications, and try at that point later on with specifically with BASIC, try to interact with in that case with Windows to see if we can automate certain things, or we can mm-hmm. influence certain things, or mm-hmm. annoy people with annoying pings or that kind of stuff, but interact with the operating system basically. Mm-hmm. So these were the kind of things I started with, and after that, so later on in high school, we had some kind of informatics classes, mm-hmm. and there's where we more on a structural level learned what programming was, uh-huh. And then you try to create smaller games or smaller things with interfaces for users that are actually have some purpose. Uh-huh. So yeah. Uh-huh.
And your dad was a programmer because he created
He was not. He was a my dad is by trade. My dad is a firefighter.
Wow.
But he was always, but he did his formal education was in electro technician.
Okay.
So everything with that, he started with that, and he was always interested in gadgets and new things.
Okay.
So we had a computer. I had a computer available at quite an early age, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I rolled into it. He was always like, okay, how can we do that? And he's now in his 70s and he's still like, How can I do this myself? Or how are you doing this these days? And he's still quite active on that. So that's remarkable.
So, and he does some Java as well?
No. He does not program, but he's more of like, for instance, he's always been into what I said, electronic, but also into mechanics as in cars. Like, okay, you know, the cars nowadays are all fly by wire, and you need mm-hmm. to plug a certain thing in to read out what kind of mm-hmm. He was like, okay, where can I get these programs, where can I might might download these programs, regardless if it is legal or illegal. I don't want to get involved into that. And how can I do this myself? And mm-hmm. that has always been his way of thinking. And I think that I adopted that and said, okay, you can do certain things yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was specifically attached to the computer science part. So that's how it all started.
So your Zoe is now faster than Tesla, right?
No, it's not. I still drive a petrol car here.
Ah, okay.
So, petrol car.
So it looks like a Mad Max and always afterburner on everything, right?
No. Just a regular, like quite up to date petrol driven car, because the whole thing of physical mechanics, like I understand how it works, but I'm not the person that wants to open up the car and
but this is what I wanted to ask, that you mentioned a screwdriver, no, with before the Game Boy came out, the LCD. Yeah. So I thought you disassembled your cars, you know.
No, I did that as a, because my dad was always working on these kind of things in his spare time. So I did help him during my early ages in this case disassembling his car. Mm-hmm. And
This was great help.
Like, hey, we need to attach this to that, and then maybe you can help. Like, so I was the assistant mechanic.
Oh, very good.
Like that. Mm-hmm. But I was never intrigued to do that on my own, because, for instance, my car, I see that as one of my lifelines. As in, I need my car to get to mm-hmm. the grocery stores, and mm-hmm. because it's quite far away. And I learned to let the experts look at it.
Outsourcing. This is what we call outsourcing, right?
Exactly. It's just nowadays the same with people say, like, oh, I can do it all with the same because I've got Claude code and I can now program my own stuff. It's like, do that. That might work once or twice, but if you wanna go overboard, then you probably need an expert that does this better and stronger and can maintain it. And that's how I see a lot of things, for instance, in the house or with my car. Like, I leave that to the experts. Yes, it will cost me money, but I'm also of a certain insurance that it will actually work.
And yeah, this is reasonable, and we can also save time, right? So if the experts do something, it is a way faster, and it is not worth to do everything by yourself, because you have to have some priorities. Otherwise, you're just doing things and nothing properly, at least. You know? Yeah,
exactly. Or it is like, it's a good enough, but it will take you way more time than an expert. And in the end, in that time, I could have either do something else or maybe just enjoy a little bit of free time or time with the family or that kind of stuff. So it's always a balance.
And the axe shaving is also a little bit problem, because if you would like to do something, the first thing you need is tools. So you can do some research, you know, to buy the tools, but we always find better tools than we found before. So we can spend, you know, days with tools. Then we have the proper tools, but how to use the tools. So we'll need the proper training with the tools. And at the end of the day, you will fix something which should actually take 10 minutes, but it costs you, I don't know, 2 weeks of work, and you learn something, but after 2 months you forget it again, right? So this is
absolutely or you learned how to do it, or more importantly, you learned how not to do it, but now you still need an expert to fix your mess.
Or you could do is you could start a blog, you know, and write about that, you know, so
you can actually probably make a career out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Make YouTube videos out of that or something.
Yeah, this is what I try with the podcast. Yeah. And okay, that's cool. So you started. So what you did, you know, something. What I wanted to ask you. So you started to program a little bit because you were curious, but in one point of time, you did. You started, or you did something which you say, okay, I would like to do it for a living, or for in my leisure or whatever. So what was the transition from curiosity to something more serious?
Okay. I think it was at the end of high school, we had, what I said, we had informatics classes, mm-hmm. and that triggered me, as in, okay, this is not just you write a script over here and you could do something a little bit funny or interesting, which is never as good as the real programs at that point. But And that triggered that class triggered me as in, okay, this is interesting. And I was always like the subjects that I had at high school, the chosen subjects were always in the science part. Science and chemistry and then mathematics. And I was like, okay, I think this is my niche. I was not the kind of guy that went into languages. And I'm not being programming languages, but like I have this
linguistic.
So the problem with me was always like I misspell things and that kind of stuff. So I chose my site. I'm more of a beta person than an alpha person, if you can call it like that, or a gamma person. I'm not sure. I'm a beta person, like the logical part. So I found out that the logical part works with me. If there's logic in it, then and then I found extreme logic in programming. Like that needs to be logical because everything can be traceable if you go back to old school programming. Like there is everything is logic. And the same with electronic circuit boards. Like it's logic. And that attracted me. Like there's no way of interpreting it wrong or something like that. It's logic. And programming was the easiest way to do that or to interact with it directly and to interfere with that. You didn't need much. You had a computer, which we already had, and you could do things with that. So that triggered my curiosity in high school that I went to that subject. And then I learned more and more. I was like, okay, maybe I should go to college and make that my choice, because I think this is one of the subjects I enjoyed the most and it fits the profile. So, I went there, I did some, how do you call that? Some task classes, as in you go there for a day, you see if the school is appropriate. And I found out that there was a school not that far from us that I could do a bachelor degree on software engineering. It was like, okay, this is quite interesting if you can formalize this and actually learn how to make proper software. And that's how I started and never looked back ever since. I think that was the way I enjoyed it. And then after that, after my bachelor's degree, I decided like, okay, I did my formal education on how to do software engineering with all sort of practices and all sort of patterns and methodologies. But still, this is a very practical way of doing this. I decided to do my master's in Utrecht in the Netherlands. And that my master's was more on the mathematical side of programming, like how to do compiler construction, how to look into how to proof logic from a mathematical point of view. So we can test it, but some cases, if it needs to be foolproof, you can mathematically prove it. It was not my best subject, but it was something that interested me. I passed that subject. And then we went into like how to create your own languages, how do things work under the hood to...
So it's like formal sure methods as we did, right? So like...
Yeah. So basically mathematics on paper, like if you have a certain program or a certain expression, how can you prove that these are the only outcomes? If I can bring it back to that, you can mathematically prove these kind of things. Obviously, if you're in a set that has not that many or no external inputs or external influences from the outside, so say. Things like IO technically is an external influence, as in you don't know exactly how long it takes or something like that. But the program itself, you can mathematically prove a lot of things. And that was typically university style kind of subject. So we did that. It was not my best subject. I was not great at it, but I found it interesting. That triggered me again when we got into more formal ways of creating program analysis programs for compilers and starting to overwrite your own compiler, starting to experiment with abstract syntax trees, which made me more curious about how do things work under the hood in different languages and why should I use something over something else, or why should I use a certain data type over something else. So it's been a natural step for me to do that. Nowadays, that is some stuff that I might know or I have back in my books and not to use on a daily basis, but it makes me think I think it makes me think and reason in a different way sometimes than just like, oh, it works on my machine, fine, let's ship it.
Yeah, it becomes more and more, the formal methods become more and more important, you know, with the all AI stuff. In one point of time, you will have to ask in one point of time, is it hallucination or not, right? So this is like, this is a still problem to solve. And by the way, you know for sure Leslie Lamport, right?
Sorry, again.
Leslie Lamport?
No, sorry.
The Mr. Leslie Lamport, he just, you know, he was famous for, he wrote a paper, Verification and Specification of Concurrent Programs. And he was full into, you know, formal proof that the programs are working correctly and so forth. So it was 1993, 2000s. So, and there was... Yeah.
Oh, he's also the. Yeah, I just looked it up.
Yeah,
to be fair, he is also the initial developer of LaTeX. The
Leslie Lamport. This what I didn't know. So he did a workshop in the Netherlands. Interestingly, also didn't know that. But Leslie Lamport, he was completely into formal methods. And he even worked for, I don't know whether he worked for, his ideas were used at AWS to prove, you know, the correctness of S3 from the math perspective. Exactly what you said. So you will like, you know, the papers. You have some leisure because you outsourced, you know, your car to the garage. You can enjoy his papers.
Maybe. It's an issue. Like, I haven't touched this stuff like in years.
No, before. For sure. It was just kidding.
So, uh-huh. It is interesting and quite difficult stuff to read. But yeah, back in the day, it was something that was part of that master program, mm-hmm. and I probably have read papers of him. Like if I see what he did, like in a quick glance,
because he was in one point of time also popular outside, you know, the papers. So maybe I don't know. 10 years ago or longer. So there were lots of discussion about his ideas in our community as well. So this is why I remember his name. It's not like I read his papers. It's more like, you know, it became popular, I don't know, 10 to 15 years ago. And
honestly, the name did not ring a bell. But if I look up his Wikipedia page, it's like, this is an interesting guy, and I definitely used stuff or read stuff.
Yeah, you had to
produce, but
pretty sure.
But the name did not, like, back in the day, when I was in university, you did not look at who wrote this; you look at what was in it.
Probably, exactly. You're absolutely right. This was also my case. Yeah,
yeah. And, so that's probably the case.
So what happened after university?
After university, I was like, okay, the university stuff, as in the being a researcher, was not my thing. Mm-hmm. I was more on the practical side of things, like build stuff for people. Mm-hmm. So what I did, I decided to take a step into like business, basically, as in being a software engineer for a company, mm-hmm. and going back to actually what I was, what my former education, as in my bachelor education, was preparing me for. The point was, because I had this package of knowledge from the university, I believe it made me a more thorough programmer. So I started developing for a small company here in the Netherlands that did both their own hardware and software.
Wow.
What they did, they did temperature management. So they bring out sensors, basically, uh-huh. for medical reasons or for, how do you say, restaurants or something like that. You want to, if you left your fridge open, mm-hmm. like say you're a big restaurant or something like that, you leave your fridge open and your temperature is below a certain level, you know that the stuff that you have in it is not good enough anymore due to regulations to serve to people. Same holds with medication if you want to have vaccines or something like that. So we built these kind of systems. They built the hardware and I was in the software team also to prove that, for instance, if a vaccine was transported from A to B, that the sensors were in and we could verify that they were between or in between a certain level of temperature that they were still valid to use. Mm-hmm. So the company still exists, and I started there as a junior developer, and learned to put my theoretical practices and my education into real practice. Like, okay, how does this work in the real life? And that was interesting, because then you come up with all the dynamics that come with business.
Yeah. And you did Java back then?
Yeah. Yeah. We started, like, we did the back end, or I was in the back end team, and the front end, that case, the front end was also like Java based, as in mm-hmm. we started with Java server faces mm-hmm. back in the day. Mm-hmm. But we built this stuff because it was more or less an incoming stream of samples from all sorts of sensors all over mm-hmm. the place. So we built this based on an enterprise service-based architecture, mm-hmm. and that was the first time I was like, okay, never heard what this is. So let's go with the architects and the senior developers. Like, okay, what is the idea behind this? And that was interesting to find out. Okay, I can apply certain methodologies or certain structures in a real life program that people depend on, and that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. How you learn Java?
Formal education. So my first education in my bachelor education was based on Java.
And you liked that?
Sorry?
You liked Java?
I liked Java. I think, but I'm not sure if I liked Java because of Java. It was more or less like we started with Java, so that was the first language that we started with. After that, we did some low level stuff in first in assembly, then in C, and then in C++, to see how things migrated. And you don't have to always create if you create software for a microcontroller or something. You don't have to go the low level of assembly programming, but you can do it in C++. Or something like that. So I did a couple of languages back in my college days, mm-hmm. And I think Java was one of the things I used the most. However, after my bachelor's, I did my master's, and my master's I did some mathematics on it, mm-hmm. but most of the programming was done in Haskell, so very functional, super functional style programming. My first job with the sensor team program, what I just told you, that was a Java shop. And I think at that point I went just out of university, and I was looking, okay, I did all sorts of things. I did some C# in one of my internships. Mm-hmm. So it's more like, okay, this is my spectrum of languages that I know. Which jobs can I get? So I was in a job market, and I think I started out as a professional Java developer because this was the job that stood out the most at the back in, what was it, 2010,
mm-hmm.
2009, like that era. It's like, oh, this one is interesting, as in the whole use cases, and they were working in Java, so I had to transfer back into Java,
mm-hmm.
And then deep dive into it to see what all the things were doing. So I did Java back in my during my formal education, and my first job forced me pretty much to get into Java because that was their stack. And I was there ever since, I guess. Uh-huh.
And how you like Haskell? Because this is a strange language.
It's a super strange language. It's a weird language to work with because the whole things of pure functional programming and no side effects, that thing. What I do like about it is that you see these kind of concepts of functional I won't say Haskell is a perfect language, but it learned me how to think in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for instance, and programmers will look at you weird, like, there are no loops mm-hmm. in Haskell.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing. No, you use, for instance, you use recursion
mm-hmm.
to a certain state. You use a certain kind of abstractions to a level that you're like, what? What are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think and work in with a different mindset. It's a really different way of developing. And people try to do that now, like, for instance, in Java, since Java 8 with the streaming mm-hmm. API, mm-hmm. try to like higher order functions. That was always already a thing. That's a thing since the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But oh, you can do now lambdas with it. Like, yeah, that's not new. I was waiting for that for ages until that was coming, and that I can give a function to a function as a parameter. Mm-hmm. So it helps me to understand it better, mm-hmm. To not misuse it, mm-hmm. And to a certain extent how it was used. And sometimes I catch myself into I'm trying to develop something, and my initial idea is, for whatever reason, is a recursive idea. And I'm like, okay, that's not a great idea in Java, maybe, in depending on how much load comes into there. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should do this in a loop. Mm-hmm. So it learns me to think in different structures and different ways. And therefore, I think I have a kind of a broad spectrum in what kind of solution can I apply to a certain problem, or can I rewrite a certain solution into something else if it's more applicable. So it helped me shape me. The language itself is kind of hard to grasp and kind of hard to learn. Mm-hmm. But I do, if people want to go into functional programming, mm-hmm. and really want to learn about functional programming, I would say pick Haskell or any of these mm-hmm. really formal, strict functional programming languages. And work your way through that. If you can do that, you grasp the idea of, okay. or you have the real idea of how these paradigms work and what the differences are.
But it's not like you are now programming the Christmas lights with Haskell, right?
No. Okay. If I'm programming the Christmas lights, I probably use whatever is available. I love Java. I use a lot of Java, but in some cases, for instance, if I need to program something and there's an interface for Python on it, I use Python. I think we should look at what is most applicable, and not everything is an enterprise project.
Yeah. You're right.
So yeah, that.
But what happens to me is with Java 25 and all the scripting, for me it's very easy to write automation stuff with Java. Like move a file, you know, this is files move, files copy. It's very easy. And with the ShareBank, you know, availability of Java, I have lots of scripts migrated from shell scripts to Java, and they are shorter in Java and easier to understand for me. And I have lots of small things. So for me, the reverse happened. So years ago, I implemented or written a lots of shell scripts or scripts to automate things, and even sometimes with functions. So it was almost like programming mm-hmm. language. And now I'm migrating everything to Java, and it is shorter, easier, and faster. So,
True.
And I'm really curious about Python. And I took a look at Python, and in one case, I had to migrate something from Python to Java. And surprisingly, from my perspective, Java was not only shorter but easier. So I'm curious, you know, about the Python movement, because I think if you are reasonable with Java, not at all enterprise, you just use Java without any dependencies. It is amazing what you can achieve. You know, the recent Java, even embedded web server is built in. So I use the embedded server for web development instead of strange Node.js servers because...
absolutely.
So, you know, yes. This is already in Java. I say, okay, launch it. And then another system runtime, open index.html, and it opens the browser, and I'm done, basically, right?
I think in most cases, why I said, like, I do nowadays, even my scripting stuff, if I can use Java, I probably use Java mm-hmm. because that is the language I am most familiar with. Mm-hmm. For instance, a year ago or a year and a half ago, I wanted to create a bot for Blue Sky. Mm-hmm. Well, the easiest way to do that was to do it in Python. Like, I did some Python in the mm-hmm. past. I can do that. Like, it's not that hard. The thing is, in most cases, that people are very looking at the language that they are most comfortable in, as in, mm-hmm. And that's a good thing, by the way. Like you are most comfortable in doing this in language A, for instance, Java. And I would choose Java as my first pick anytime. Then I would do it in Java. Nowadays I use JBang mm-hmm. a lot for creating scripts. Back in the day when that was not a case, I probably used some dirty Python. To do that because it was easier than for me. It was easier to read and to comprehend than pure Bash. So it was more of like what do I have at my disposal, and what is the easiest way of doing that? And it can, the easiest way can also be like, hey, if you have a team that is mostly driven by Java development, Java is just as good a language to do certain things as Python is. It's not always like this language is better than the other. It depends on multiple variables within.
But the interesting part with that is the almost the opposite of what you will assume. So a Java 1 last year, the Node.js developer approached me and say, this Java is really easy and no dependency. You just started and it worked. So actually, good feedback. And sometimes in Java projects, the Java developers are not aware that you can write, you know, very simple, easy to understand Java code with three lines of code. So it's more like I have to convince Java developers, you know, to how easy Java can be. And if I show my Java to Python or JavaScript developers, they usually like it. They say, "Hey, yeah. that's actually cool." So this is a strange part, you know, because I don't know why. I know why. So the Java developers I used to write, you know, 20 layers to get a file and display a string on terminal. And the other programmers are more pragmatic. You know, a Python developer, I assume, will never do that. Just, you know, get file.
I mean, the language itself already, like, for instance, if you look back at history Java, if you have a language that is strictly typed like Java, you need to do some steps extra. Absolutely. But what you see now is that if people make fun of Java, they use the jokes that were applicable 10 years ago. I was like, okay, yeah. you haven't touched Java in at least a decade, because making the fun games about how many imports do you need for your abstract class or like that was basically because there was always enterprise level Java with so many layers, with so many abstraction layers. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't have to do that. And that, I think you also see that internally. If you go into, say, your random bank or insurance companies, you see that people are sticking there for a decade, mm-hmm. or it's long term project, and people still have that mindset from 5 to 10 years ago. Like, hey, this was how we did it.
Yeah.
Yes, but there are new constructs. There are new ways. The language has improved. So, I think it's also because enterprise moves slowly, mm-hmm. as in it's very, very, very rigid, very.
But it changes a bit, right? So new projects they're using Java, starting with Java 25. So it is more faster than 10 years ago, far more, especially if new projects are starting. You know, if a new project is starting, you can do whatever you like. And I would say 5 to 10 years ago, you have to be more strict, and it has to, you know, be all the layering. There were crazy enterprise architects demanding, you know, crazy patterns. And right now, you can be reasonable also in enterprise projects. Is at least what I find. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, true. But mm-hmm. I think it's like the point of the programmer as well. Like, how much do you want to learn about what the new features are in the newer versions of mm-hmm. of Java? That can be like you say, the new cool kids or like the data scientists, they use the language, well, mostly like they use Python nowadays, and not probably because it's Python, because they think it's easy to learn, or it's at some cases it's something that can solve their problem.
Mm-hmm.
What do enterprise level developers
partially now, right? Because if you look at data scientists, they use the Jupyter notebooks, and the question is how to run it in production, right?
So sure, okay, sure. But if they just need to produce data, then
this is true. Mm-hmm.
This and what you see in enterprise level development, and for some reason, I think it's logical, as in people want to solve a problem, and you ask this to say a 45-year-old developer that has been doing backend Java for ages and may not have written newer Java. He was like, okay, I can do this. And he does his old layered systems with old for loops and maybe very verbose code, which still works. But there are different styles of programming. If you do Java now with newer style programming or the kids that pick up Java nowadays, and they do these kind of small things like, oh, this is cool. Like,
yeah. Yeah, just reading a file is in new Java is files read string. You're done, right? So there's nothing.
That's what I mean. So I think the language is moving faster than many of the users can and want to comprehend, because for them it's a job, which is fine.
Yeah, you're right.
But so I think it's not wrong in my opinion. It's more or less like, hey, there are just different ways of developing these things in one language, and it's not anymore that this language can only do verbose, or you can only you need to write verbose code in Java to make it work. No, not.
Also, interesting point you mentioned with the the data scientists. If they solve the problem, they do it. And I think we Java developers think a little bit differently. So recently, a client asked me for a proof of concept in Java. And there was some old code. So I took the look at the code and it said, okay, we could do this, but in your company, it will never run in production. Because, there was some problem with threading or whatever. So I can tell you the algorithm will work if we proceed, but we will have to completely rewrite it to make it work, you know? So I think the Java developers, they're already thinking how we can run it in production. Will it break in production? I think there are not that many Java projects with just proof of concepts where we know, okay, should we just test it and it will, and we don't care about later, right? So I think the Java developers maybe, or this is my impression at least, they already think, you know, what happens later. Maybe because of the experience that there was lots of trouble in productions we had to solve, you know, all the years. So now we would like to avoid it because, you know, sleepless nights are no more that fascinated than in 2000s.
I think there's a very logical explanation in that as well, as in Java and I think C# as well, to that extent, are the, in my opinion, still the two main languages for huge backends. And a huge backends, I mean like the insurance companies, the government, and it's very heavily used there. And there's a reason for that. Java can work well, can be optimized over time. It's not, if you benchmark it, obviously you can have, if you do it once or twice, you can have it faster in another language. But over time, or on how the JVM works, it will accommodate to the use. And we can go into JVM internals all day, but that is a very strong thing. So that means also that Java developers need to know what kind of load do I have, what kind of backend do I have, and because it's used in these kind of big corporates or government, like if a bank goes down because you ran out of threats, or I know your connection pool to your database has starvation or something like that, then you have a huge impact. The impact is way bigger in these kind of companies. So you need, as a developer, you need to think about load, concurrency, and all these kind of things that make the world go round. And yes, a simple, if I do it on my machine, it works. Yeah, try that with, say, 100,000 to a million requests per second. And if that works, and then the languages or the developers that work on these kind of projects are mostly in enterprise. So, and because Java is well fit since ever for backend enterprise, I think a Java developer in that case thinks more of that. Okay, but how can we scale this? Can we duplicate this? Do we need to shard certain things? How does threading works? Because the impact of a mistake in that is way bigger than if you do it for a small startup or your pet project or your data science project internally into your company.
Yeah, and we already had the experience because Java is older that we had already problems in production and we just tried to avoid it, right? So this is less experiments. What happens after your Zenso tracking or temperature tracking company?
Oh, okay, great. After my temperature tracking, I did that for about 4 years or something. I worked at a company and then I started to work consultancy-based. I worked for a small consultancy firm and I got into... say mid or longer term projects at the bigger firms in the Netherlands. So I worked for, you've been there once. I've worked for Blue4IT. You've been there.
This was a nice company. So they invited me once.
Exactly, but it was a small consultancy firm. We were like 20 Mm-hmm. 20 developers and mm-hmm. one manager. And what we did, we worked at banks and insurance companies as in, okay, they need an extra developer there, or they need, like, they don't have so many internal developers, or well, you got there as part of an external team.
We met back then at the company.
Yeah.
Hey, cool.
Yeah, you were. I think it was. We had an offsite in Utrecht or something like mm-hmm. that, and you gave a session for us. That was in my beginning days, my starting days as a consultant. So I did that for a bunch of years, working for banks and government and mm-hmm. Larger retail companies with huge systems. I did that for I don't know. 6-7 years, I don't know, mm-hmm. Some years. And after that, I already started speaking and sharing knowledge and trying to do workshops and teach as in, if you can call that, to share what I had to what I think of things, for instance, on how to do functional programming but uh-huh. with the Java API, how that worked, like the overlap, like so I was already out in the community. I started to be more active, and then I got approached by a very, very infamous name, by Simon Maple in this case, mm-hmm. And he asked me to join Sneak, uh-huh. and I joined Sneak as a hybrid engineer / developer advocate, as in, okay, we need to. Like the mission was more like, okay, we want to make developers more aware of and developing in a more secure way, mm-hmm. as in not take security as a afterthought, mm-hmm. but I try to incorporate that in their way of thinking and doing. And that was ever since my mission. So I started there in, what is it, 2019 ish?
Okay. Yeah. And you're still working for Sneak?
Yep, I'm still working for Sneak. Sneak pays the bills for me.
Very good. So what I suggest is so that we briefly introduce Sneak right now, and the next time we meet, we just will talk about what can Sneak can do for Java developers, you know? So because you should know it, I think, if you're working for them. So it's always interesting, you know? What are the features we can buy from Sneak as a Java developer or company or whatever? What is it? And what, it's always interesting, you know? And maybe introduce briefly how Sneak started, if you know it. So what is the company, you know, what is behind? So just introduction.
I will give you a very, very short pitch of what Sneak is.
Yeah.
Sneak is a company that creates tooling for developers.
Is it a Netherlands-based company or no?
No. I will come back to that. Give mm-hmm. me a second. So Sneak is a company that creates developer tooling mm-hmm. for developers, but focusing on security.
Uh-huh.
And what we want is that making security not an afterthought, so for security engineers or for the security team, but just like things like unit tests and that kind of stuff, it needs to be part of your development lifecycle.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that with tools that can connect to your GitHub repository that scan both your code and your dependencies and check if you have supply chain issues mm-hmm. with your dependencies or your Docker containers or whatever, mm-hmm. or your own code if that goes wrong. And nowadays also things like, hey, if you vibe code it with your AI assistant, mm-hmm. Make sure that at least it's checked because they can hallucinate, or even including MCP service, for instance, can bring a toxic flow in.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so we create tooling, and we do that in all sorts of ways, like integrated in a CI or a CLI, integrated in your CI pipeline, but also giving you plugins for all of the IDEs, so that it's close to the developer. We started out as a shop. What is it? 10+ years ago, that was from the Node. That was in the Node developer, Node.js developer space, because if you see how many packages are out on NPM, it's crazy. There are, if you want,
but NPM is NPM is highly secure. There is nothing to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because everybody can post your NPM package there, and there's no form of control span in that. or well, not that's not totally true, but like it's easy to just publish a package, an NPM, and put malicious code in that. So
and change existing packages is the problem, right? So
for instance, or the thing that the whole NPM ecosystem works like, if you want to install NPM package, there is it runs software for you, as in there is a post-run script or a pre-run script or whatever. Like you have the same with Python, by the way, which if you put some hidden code in there, it can install Trojans or it can duplicate stuff or whatever. It's dangerous. It's like it runs on your machine instead of it's a package like a jar that is a dependency on Java. But anyway, getting back, there were a lot of packages in NPM, and supply chain was supply chain attacks are still a big thing. So the company started as a scanning tool for specifically NPM packages, as in, hey, these NPM packages are known and are vulnerable, and these are the vulnerabilities. And more importantly, for a developer, how can you fix it? Do you need to upgrade your higher level dependency, or do you need to create a patch to make that transitive dependency fixed? Well, that's how we started. We started with that. That was the first idea, and then we expanded that to all sorts of languages and all sorts of ecosystems, including Java. I think Java was the second ecosystem that Sneak did, and then from only dependency analysis, they went to static code analysis. There, we now do dependency dynamic analysis, container analysis, AI flow analysis, but all sorts of things based on, okay, we as developers are creating software, and I don't want to be bothered afterwards. I actually want to know if we created something like, hey, it points out that might be an issue, and we can already look at it without doing the rework afterwards. So saving yourself time, and of course that comes with other drawbacks, but that is what Sneak is doing, and it does it for a whole bunch of ecosystems. And the two biggest ecosystems are Node.js, where we started, and Java, because Java is very, very heavily available in huge enterprises. Check your own bank and they probably have Java stuff in it. And they
from
are
the popularity
concerned.
can you tell a little your feeling Node.js versus Java right now, so from your company perspective?
I don't know, I don't have the exact data.
No, exactly, no. I know it's just
but I know that we currently have more Java projects than Node.js projects, and we started out as a Node.js company or a Node.js scanner. It's still like, I won't say it's very much more, but it is. We have more.
It's just interesting to know the trend
Java project.
So it means Java is not necessarily dead, right? So this is what I want.
Oh, absolutely not. If people think that Java is dead, they have to reconsider their chain of thought. Yes.
Very good. So, so my impression is Sneak focuses on security, right? Security, and this is the focus, is not necessarily on, you know, maintainability and code complexity. Is more security. Okay.
We focus on security because if you do more than that, so for instance, if you also focus on code quality, it can be, but it's not. We're good at this, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the expert thing that we were just talking about. I get my car to the garage because they know about cars. We know a lot about security. We have our own security researchers. We have our own security evaluation team. They do that, and we want to be very, very good at it. And if you do other things as well, you might compromise.
Yeah.
Then
maybe
that is not, and that's not up, that is not up to us. That is up to the developer, in my opinion. Like, hey, if you want to make a decision to do this differently because you have reasons for that, I cannot see your reasons. I don't know your reasoning. So I am not the one that will force you to do this. If you do that, fine. But then you can at least make an educated decision. And that's what we want.
Very good. So I will re-invite you back because, and we can talk about, you know, the some security problems in Java, and then of course how they can be solved with Sneak, and some interesting stuff, you know. So for Java developers, maybe like should be fun again. So and where people can find you on the internet, you, your company and blog or whatever you have.
Well, Sneak obviously at Sneak, SNYK. So it's a little bit weirdly spelled, but that's how the founders found it interesting. So sneyk.io, S-N-Y-K.io, that's the company website. You can find me on the internet by just Googling Brian Vermeer, and you will probably find my website. It's brianvermeer.nl because I'm Dutch. That's also the handle for Blue Sky. I think I'm easily findable. Same for LinkedIn. Brian Vermeer is not that hard to find. Specifically, if you put something in as either Sneyk or Java, then you will find.
Yeah, perfect. It was really nice. Thank you, and see you next time.
Absolutely. Talk to you later.